Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the December 3rd edition of the County Chronicle. We'll begin with the first page stories. Arcola City Council. TIF Committee approves apartment upgrades by David Porter. Arcola's tax increment financing TIF Committee approved two requests for assistance on the same property. The request will now go to the full City Council. The property is a five-unit apartment at 106 North Oak Street owned by JC Legacy LLC. The first request is for up to $25,000 in eligible expenses for the improvements. The second is for up to $20,000 for a storefront rebate. The application was made by Stacy and Joycionia Robinson. Chris Robinson is the contractor on the project. Both projects call for $300,000 in improvements, including gutting the interior and rebuilding it. Facade improvements include tuck pointing, siding, cleaning, and replacing doors and windows. At the December 1st meeting, the council approved an annual abatement of taxes for general obligation bonds in the amount of $110,000. The bonds are guaranteed by property taxes, but the abatement means the city will pay those costs from other funds rather than property taxes. The city also set its tax levy at $340,000. Also approved were holiday bonuses, tourism committee report, and zoning report. The zoning report includes a portable shed for Stephen Green at 305 East Madison, valued at $8,000, and a commercial shed for ANDD Rentals at 425 South Oak Street, valued at $96,000. Fees totaled $418. Bill Wagoner, city administrator, wrote in his report that the city has a couple of prospects for the former Hen House building and hopes to have something back up and running there soon. The West Side Sewer Project will begin Monday, December 8th. B&T Drainage plans to start on the West Jefferson and will snake their way through. They'll be replacing the residence portion of the sewer where it's clay tile up to the cleanout by the house. The city also has a pre-construction meeting, Horror Construction, on December 4th for South Side Sewer Lining. The work should not affect resident service other than blocking the road at a time. The Libman Road project is completed. Wagoner said the IDOT, Illinois Department of Transportation, paperwork has been submitted to close out the project, and we're just waiting for our final reimbursement for the city. The Main Street project is also wrapped up for the most part, he said. There are more handrails in production, and these will be installed soon, weather permitting. The next article is the Tuscola School Board. Encouraging audit, inappropriate material allegation against a substitute turned over to the state's attorney, by David Porter. Tuscola Schools made the state's financial recognition list this year with a score of 3.8 out of 4, according to auditor Russ Lee. When the state tells you you're doing a good job, it doesn't mean anything, in my opinion, he said. In the education fund, income exceeded expenses by $709,000, he said, and the district has more than a year of cash on hand. Other funds are not as flush, with transportation running an $83,000 deficit. You might have to look at that in the future, Lee said. He said education funding is down across the board from state and federal resources, he said. The state is $3.1 million short in what they're supposed to contribute, he said, surprise, surprise. He said the Tuscola district should be okay with money coming in from the state's personal property replacement tax and with local property taxes. Tuscola is in the top end of districts your size, really good shape. He said expenses have been pretty well maintained and the only big jump being in special education. Tuscola schools should be all right for a few years, he said. He added the district still has bonding powers if they need it. He said the spending per pupil was $15,300, which is up from last year. He said there are a few more students this year. He said the cost per student is on the low side, with many schools showing $17,000 to $20,000 per student. He said the district's pension liability is $587,000 short, and that there is renewed talk in Springfield about bringing that responsibility back to local taxing body. He said Tuscola schools are able to eat it with the balances you've got. In the public portion of the meeting, held November 24th, Brian Cordes addressed his dissatisfaction with a meeting he had with former Northward principal Jason Wallace. He described the meeting as unprofessional and said there was a police present that he had not been alerted to. He suggested the district institute a policy of notifying parents if a police presence is requested. He added that Superintendent Gary Alexander told him he was unaware that the police had been called. Cordes said the principal should work to de-escalate tensions, implying that the police presence did the opposite. Cordes is a junior high teacher in the Villa Grove district. His kids attend Tuscola schools. During Alexander's portion of the meeting, he said transportation funding from the state is 71%. He said the district will probably have to make changes if the trend continues. He said the school report card showed a commendable rating, but added that he cautions the board members against believing everything. He suggests the school report cards issued by the state lack context and are created more for the news media. A comparison of ratings compiled by the News Gazette showed that Tuscola's North Ward Elementary School ranked the lowest among the area schools with a score of 51.50. The cutoff for exemplary standards for middle and elementary schools is 81.99. Tuscola High School came in at 82.25. The cutoff for exemplary for high schools is 93.02. Tuscola High ranked below Arthur Levington Atwood Hammond, 87.39, and Arcola High School, 85.18. Tuscola's East Prairie Middle School came in at 74.37. Scores are based on absenteeism and certain test scores, including English, math, and science. Other scores in the County Chronicle's coverage area were Villa Grove High, 75.83, Villa Grove Elementary, 74.15, Arcola Elementary, 72.1, Villa Grove Junior High, 68.23, Arthur Grade School, 60.22, Atwood Hammond Grade School, 58.96, Levington Grade School, 55.96. The Tuscola District's tax levy is up by 8.1%, Alexander said. Due to increases in equalized assessed valuation, he said he expects the actual tax rate to go 4.63% to 4.64%. Truth in Taxation hearing is set for December 18th. Following the meeting, Alexander was asked about status of a substitute teacher who allegedly was viewing inappropriate material on the computer at school, which was witnessed by students. Alexander said the matter was turned over to the local police and said he could confirm that the person will no longer be substitute teaching in Tuscola. Tuscola Police Chief Craig Hastings said the matter was turned over to the state's attorney's office for review. While the alleged action violated school policy, it is unclear whether it violates the law. The next front page story, Tuscola Builders expanding under new ownership by David Porter. Tuscola Builders just got a bigger. The family-owned concrete manufacturing company was bought this year by IMI, Irving Machine Incorporated of Indianapolis, Indiana, which operates more than 200 concrete plants in five states. Previous owner, Shannon Smith of rural Tuscola, said he was happy to be able to sell the plant to another family-owned company. While IMI is much larger, it is in its fourth generation of family ownership, which began in 1928. The Tuscola plant on Chicago Avenue started in 1953. It was purchased in 1982 by Ron Smith of Arcola, who also owned a trucking company. Shandon Smith said he started working at the plant by the time he was 14 or 15, operating an end loader. At 18, he got his CDL truck license and started hauling concrete while also attending college. "It's the only job I've ever had," he quipped. "This is the first time I've been a W-2 employee." When Ron Smith retired, Shandon acquired the plant with his brother Shane. Shandon bought his brother's share 6.5 years ago. He said he will continue to work for IMI, but will move into operations management, overseeing other plants, while Chad Melton was promoted to plant manager. Smith said his intent was to stay with IMI for 2 years until his son, Bricks, graduates from high school here, but daughter Vivian has 6 more years in school. Now Chris, his wife, the former Christina Adams, is saying she wants to stay until Vivi graduates. When asked about his long-term goals, the 55-year-old Smith was succinct. "Relax, sit on the beach, maybe play a little golf." Although Schmidt is an Arcola graduate, class of 1988, he's become fond of the Warrior black and gold and has used on his trucks. IMO will be making a lot of improvements to the Tuscola plant, he said, including adding new trucks, which will be red and white in keeping with the buyer's colors. IMO is very conscious of appearances and will be cleaning up the area on Tuscola's west edge just north of the police station, Smith said. They'll be modernizing the plant and increasing its production capabilities. Will also be a crushing of old slabs of concrete stored there to be recycled. IMI has a recycling division, Smith said, and also owns 30 stone quarries and 15 asphalt plants. He said the company's size will allow it to be much more competitive. "The biggest expense for concrete production is the cement," he said. "They can buy that in much greater quantities. Service should be greatly increased," he said. "I have 9 trucks. They will have close to 75 trucks available." The company started to expand into Illinois this year, Smith said, with the Tuscola plant being their 5th acquisition. They own plants in Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio. The next article, Tuscola School District releases investigative report on principal by David Porter. The Tuscola School Board accepted the resignation of Jason Wallace as elementary school principal at its November 24th meeting. The action comes on the heels of an investigative report that stated that Wallace had violated district policies on sexual harassment based on a preponderance of the evidence standard. The investigation conducted by IN Compliance Consulting also recommended sexual harassment training for other staff members in light of how they handled the allegations made against Wallace. Katie Osborne of IN Compliance wrote that several witnesses interviewed were aware that the allegations of sexual harassment, and rather than reporting it, either suggested the complainant confront Wallace directly, change her own behavior, or reach their own judgment as to whether her report was valid. While the report describes victim shaming by other staff, it stated that it does not fault the employees for failing to recognize their obligations to report allegations due to the persuasive nature of Wallace's conduct and the apparent building culture he fostered when such conduct was deemed acceptable. The report shows that Wallace denied wrongdoing and said his conduct was not based on romantic intent. He portrayed it as attempting to be supportive and caring of a complainant while she was going through a difficult time, and that he made some of his statements in a joking manner. The report states that the evidence supports that the complainant had told Wallace that his comments and actions made her uncomfortable. It described her responses to suggested text messages as attempting to change the subject or not responding at all. She even had a code word witness name redacted by the school district due to fear that Wallace would show up at her home. The report also concluded that Wallace subjected the complainant to a hostile environment which denied her equal access to the school district's educational program. The complainant described sneaking out of the classroom to avoid encounters with Wallace and mental health stress. The 45-page report details numerous allegations, including side hugs, kissing on top of the head, touching, texting, and in-person comments. Some of the staff members whose names were redacted by the school district noted that Wallace did these things with other staff members, and that's just the way he is. One said he is a jokester guy. He cuts up and laughs with everyone in the hallway. The witness added that Wallace may be too friendly and said he jokes inappropriately with the staff. Some of the allegations could not be substantiated and were deemed inconclusive. While Wallace did not respond to previous attempt by the County Chronicle to reach out to him, he wrote an email to the newspaper Monday stating, "Please just let this go and don't print anything else about me. It's over and I have moved on. Please do the same." The teacher's aide who filed the complaint and the teacher reported the allegations have since resigned. In the last first page article, two teens charged in connection to alleged attempt murder plot by David Porter. Two teens are in custody following an alleged attempted murder Saturday in Tuscola. Tajay Nickerson, 19, was apprehended early Sunday morning and charged with attempted murder, a Class X felony, and aggravated battery. Caitlin Lampkin, 16, has been charged with conspiracy to commit murder. Police were called Saturday morning to a home in the 600 block of East Overton in Tuscola. Two people, Matthew Wilkins and Amanda Lampkin, were taken to an area hospital with cuts on their faces. They were later released and were present in the courtroom on Monday afternoon. Kathleen Lampkin was taken into custody at the scene of the alleged crime while police officers searched for Nickerson. Authorities said she briefly left the scene with Nickerson but returned. Nickerson was found around 3 a.m. Sunday hiding in a car inside a garage a couple of houses away from the alleged crime scene. Tuscola Police Chief Craig Hastings said he suspected that Nickerson, whose last known address was Urbana, would return to the home in Tuscola since there was a snowstorm that night and he had nowhere else to stay. Tracks in the snow between the house and a nearby garage led police to the suspect. Hastings said he believes the alleged attempt murder was premeditated. He added that it was neither random nor in the heat of the moment. He said Nickerson made a statement to the police after he had read his rights and told the police where to find the knife he had allegedly used. A second knife was found in the kitchen sink. Both knives, which Hastings describes as common kitchen knives, are now in evidence. Hastings has described the alleged plot as a domestic matter and said the two suspects have some history together. In March, Amanda Lampkin posted on social media that her daughter, Caitlin, who was 15 at the time, was missing and was with Nickerson, whom she thought was a dangerous person. Nickerson was convicted earlier this year on child pornography charges and served nearly a year in jail. He was sentenced to time served 257 days in the county jail. He was placed on probation, fines, and fees total $1,750. Nickerson was also charged in February with reckless conduct and inducement to commit suicide. These charges were dismissed on November 10th. Some family members have pushed back against the domestic dispute label. "He's not even family," Ashley Cannell told the County Chronicle. "He's been harassing and stalking my cousin for the last year. He kidnapped my underage cousin back in February and forced her to do stuff and threatened her." Cannell has started a GoFundMe page to try to raise money to help the family. As of press time, the page had raised $50 towards a $6,000 goal. The page can be found online at https://5dd544-24a4. Hastings said he could not give further details on the alleged crime nor Nickerson's statement since the matter is now in the court system. However, he said, "We're confident we know what happened." He added that he was proud of how his officers stepped up and concluded the investigation quickly. There was a lot of evidence to gather. He said normally an investigation like this handled by 2 to 3 officers, but in this case, the whole department committed to the pursuit and wrapped it up within 48 hours. We did it all, he said. He added that 2 county deputies went into the neighboring garage to assist with the arrest. The sheriff's office posted on social media that Deputy Lonnie Homan and Hoyt Wages played a major role in assisting the Tuscola Police Department in tracking and locating a suspect wanted in a reported domestic incident that occurred this weekend, leading to an arrest. The suspect is currently detained for a multitude of offenses, including attempted murder. Excellent work, guys. We'll move now to the obituaries. Todd Andrew Fultz, 58, of Sullivan, formerly of Arcola, passed away at 2:56 a.m. on Wednesday, November 26, 2025, at Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center in Mattoon. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, December 6th, at the New Life Church, 1502 Crooks Mill Road in Sullivan. Pastor Dave Dolan and Pastor Aaron Dolan will officiate. Burial will follow in the Arcola Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 5th, at the Edwards Funeral Home, 221 East Main Street in Arcola. Ronnie A. Sanders, 82, of Atwood, passed away at 10:30 p.m. on Friday, November 28th, 2025, at the Willow Breeze Hospice House in Mattoon, surrounded by his family. In accordance with his wishes, a private family service and burial at Humboldt Cemetery will be held. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting the family. Brenda Lee Bren Christ Kelly, 61, of Decatur, passed away peacefully at Decatur Memorial Hospital on Wednesday, November 26, 2025. Private funeral services will be held. Edwards Funeral Home is assisting with the arrangements. Joseph William Hopkins, 102, of Arcola, passed away at 2:20 p.m. on Saturday, November 22, 2025, at the Haven of Arcola. Visitation was held Friday, November 28th, at the Edwards Funeral Home, Arcola. Funeral services were held Friday at the funeral home. Joe Hackler, his grandson, officiated. Burial was in the Humboldt Cemetery. Brian Vincent McLean, 75, formerly of Arcola, passed away at his residence on Saturday, September 6, 2025. A celebration of life was held November 29th at the Main Street Gaming and Lounge in Arcola. Andrew E. Mast was born on July 8th, 1941, to Emmanuel and Sarah Mast and Arthur. He was called to his eternal reward on November 26, 2025, at Haven of Care in Arthur. Funeral services were held Sunday, November 30th, at the HCK building. Bishop Nelson Diener officiated. Burial was in the Otto Cemetery. Visitation was held Friday, November 28th, and Saturday, November 29th. The Edwards Funeral Home assisted with arrangements. Louise Bright Hahn Johnson, 86, of Charleston, passed away at 6:20 a.m. on Tuesday, November 25th, 2025, at Arbor Rose of Charleston. Memorial services will be held at 1 p.m. on Thursday, December 4th, at the Edwards Funeral Home, 221 East Main, in Arcola. Pastor Matt McGregor will officiate. The next article, Oglesby Mansion to host their traditional Christmas tea. Tradition continues at the Oglesby Mansion and Museum. Governor Richard J. Oglesby Mansion, located at 421 West Williams Street in Decatur, will host their annual Christmas tea Sunday, December 7th from 1 to 4 p.m. No reservations are necessary. The public will be able to stroll the mansion with an informal tour and see the many decorations. There will also be tea, Oglesby punch, and cookies available. Donations are accepted but not required. Stephanie Ponch will be bringing harp music into the mansion from 1:30 to 2:30. Stephanie just played during the lying in state for former Governor Jim Edgar. Christmas carols will be sung by the Oglesby Singers as well. The Garden Club of Decatur has decorated the mansion in appropriately festive attire. A group of 15 ladies decorated the mansion this year. The Decatur Quilters Guild also provided several Christmas quilts to add to the holiday decor. Visitors will experience a piece of Decatur history with a tour of this amazingly restored mansion. The mansion was built in 1875 through 76 after his second marriage. The original plans for Oglesby Mansion were by William LeBaron Jenny, a Chicago architect who is known best for describing the first modern skyscraper. The Oglesbys modified the plans a great deal and hired a local contractor to build the home for them. Two of their 4 children were born while they lived in the house. In 1882, they moved to Lincoln, Illinois. Governor Oglesby was elected to 3 non-consecutive terms as Illinois governor. The next article, Turkeys More Than Thanksgiving Dinner at Windsweep Farm, by Phyllis Coulter. Feathered gobblers are much more than the center of customers' holiday meals for Renee Coaster and her family in Windsweep Farm in Lee County. For Coster, turkeys are the curious creatures that greet her. They're funny. Our building is open on one side and they all come running when they see you, she said. A turkey is also the bird of choice for Coster's Easter meal. And for a 10-year-old son, Colin Coster, a turkey is a way to learn about earning money at 4-H projects and a pet. Renee Coster farms near Dixon with her dad, Leonard Schaefer, and her husband, Peter Coster, focusing on direct marketing, diverse natural products. We have 5 children. The older ones help on the farm, Coster told Farm Week. Windsweep Farms also grows organic soybeans, wheat, corn, and soybeans. Turkeys are more just one than are just one more thing we do, said Coster, who started her farm by milking a couple of dairy cows in 2002. She added more dairy cows, beef calves, hogs, laying hens, and broilers over time. 7 years ago, she added turkeys. The current state of the flock is 40. Overall, Windsweep Farm is only a tiny part of the turkey business in the state. According to the Illinois Corn Growers Association, farmers raise nearly 3 million turkeys statewide each year. Almost all of Coster's customers want their turkeys during the holiday season, so most are already spoken for this year, but there are still some available. There's not a lot of demand outside of the holiday season, Coster said. However, she breaks the tradition by serving turkey at Easter. Last year, it was a 32-pounder for 35 guests. She quartered it to make it easier to handle, brined it to add flavor and moisture. She smoked half and roasted the rest. What's Coster's best tip for Thanksgiving cooks? For roasting, make sure it's covered really well. Give it plenty of time. Cook it low and slow until it's fork tender, she said. The family raises 2 turkey breeds. She started with broad-breasted white turkeys because they are docile and fast-growing. After research, Coster found the more colorful Narragansett be a good addition to her flock. Narragansetts are docile, which was one of the main reasons I chose them, as my son wanted a pet turkey, so temperament was important, she said. Coster soon discovered the minimum order for poults, baby turkeys, from an Arizona supplier was 15. So Colin Coster started his farming career. He paid for a quarter of the feed costs. When the turkeys were sold, he earned a quarter of the income. He kept 2 breeding hens and Tom, a male turkey. He exhibited them at the Lee County 4-H and Junior Show and took them to other local farm promotion events. Tom is calm. You can go up to him, pick him up, she said. When people say turkeys, which take about 4 months to reach butcher weight, are hard to raise, but not for Coster. In my experience, they are just as easy as raising broilers, she said. Usually the Costers get the poults in July because they need warmth when young, and timing works well for them to be ready for the holiday season. There's an article by the Ramblin' Man, David Porter, How to Sear a Brain. I was thinking the other day about my earliest memories, which go back more than 50 years. Of course, I can't guarantee the accuracy of some of these memories. I was reminiscing with my sister recently, and she remembers some things differently than I do. I figure her memories are probably more accurate than mine because she was older than me at the time. She's still older than me, although you'd never guess it by looking at us side by side. She filled in some gaps for me. For instance, I remember sleeping in a trundle bed in a closet when I was about 5 years old, but I could not remember why. She told me it was because we had a great uncle who was recuperating in our house after a car accident, and he was using my bed. Before anyone jumps to other conclusions, it was a big closet and the door was never shut. I wasn't scarred by it. I just remember it because it was so far from routine that it was seared in my head. That got me to thinking about other select memories and why I remember some things and not others. My conclusion is that my earliest memories are not random. Most of them were extraordinary at the time, and to be fair, extraordinary was a pretty low bar. For example, I remember getting paid to take care of my neighbor's dog while they were on vacation. I was probably 7 or 8. What made it extraordinary was at the time I ever got was the first time I ever got paid for anything, and it was a higher level of responsibility than I'd had up to that point. I remember all my teachers were, but I don't remember a lot of specific situations. My mind was wandering about tonight and dropped in on 1976. I was in 6th grade. It was my bicentennial year, and my teacher, Lynn Statzer, held a mock election. One day during study hall, I wrote a poem. After the bell rang, I showed it to her. She got all excited about it and said she would have it printed in the school newspaper, which she did. The so-called school newspaper was a typewritten on a copy paper and stapled in the corner, but it was the first time I was ever published, and look at me now. That's how you sear a brain. In Margaret McDaniel's English class, I had another brain sear. Our assignment was to recite a Langston Hughes poem with extra credit if we memorized the poem. I chose my poem just before class and was hurriedly trying to memorize the 6-line poem. When it was my turn to stand up in front of the class, I paused between each line as I tried to recall what came next. I think Mrs. McDaniel interpreted each pause as intentionally dramatic effect. When I was done, she jumped to her feet, clapped her hands, and shouted, A+. At that moment, every line of the poem was permanently seared in my brain. I can still recite it today. Not every brain sear That year involved poetry and accolades. I also got my first detention for reasons I'd rather not discuss. I also tried cutting my own hair one day, and I remember a classmate commenting on the weird pattern in the back of my neck. Some other changes had taken place over the summer, and I remember that on the first day of school, a girl commented about how deep my voice had gotten. It didn't feel like a casual comment. It felt more like a spark. I didn't fully understand why at the time, but it was seared into my memory nonetheless. It was the first time a girl noticed me, and it's only happened once or twice since then. I don't remember that everybody remembers things the same way. Some people seem to have broader memories than I do, but I think we all experience brain sears, and most of those moments are unintentionally facilitated by someone else. My theory is that they can be intentional. Going out of your way to make someone's day is probably going to be remembered. Hurting someone's feelings or embarrassing them is just as likely to be remembered. So that leaves us with a choice. What kind of memory do you want to make for those around you? Don't get me wrong. I'm not all bubbles and sunshine. A corrective measure delivered pointedly can be a positive thing for the recipient, but nothing beats making someone feel special, and I'd rather be remembered as that guy. In another article, Be a Blessing for Others, Hook, Line, and Sinker by Tony Hooker. As I've chronicled here, I've picked up a side hustle over the past year that has allowed me to start making post-Parkland plans. Look at that. More alliterations. Doris Barr, my news writing one teacher at Parkland, will be slightly singularly unimpressed with my lack of professionalism, but I digress. And in both roles, I was referred to as a blessing for doing what I do. The Google AI bot says that to be a blessing for others is to willingly serve as a conduit for positive change in the world. It's a purposeful way of living where we use our unique gifts, resources, and empathy, not just for personal gain, but to lift, encourage, and support those around us. Of course, to paraphrase the late, great Phil Hartman from his Unfrozen Caveman Lawyer skit on Saturday Night Live, this modern concept frightens and confuses me. I am incapable of thinking of it in these terms. To me, being kind and relatively competent is just part of the gig. Being a blessing can be manifested by something as simple as offering a listening ear without judgment, sharing a word of sincere encouragement, or simply offering a helping hand when someone is struggling. Volunteering time, mentoring a younger colleague, or practicing radical forgiveness towards someone who has wronged you are all ways we can practice being a blessing to our fellow man. For reasons that remain unfathomable to Mrs. HLS, and frankly vague to myself, I found myself leaning into the Lord more and more these days, which must be a foreign, laughable concept to those who have known me my whole life. Nonetheless, whether through divine intervention, fear of my own mortality, or a combination of the above, I've been listening to Catholic content, reading scriptures, and going to church every week, and a particular verse seems appropriate for this week's rantings. Whatever you do for the least of these, you do for me, from the book of Matthew, really seems to fit the theme. When we actively choose to be a blessing, we can sometimes initiate a profound ripple effect. Our kindness has the opportunity to encourage recipients to pay it forward, creating a chain reaction of goodwill that expands far beyond our initial interaction. Furthermore, this act of giving can be deeply reciprocal. Focusing on others' needs fosters a greater sense of purpose, gratitude, and connection within ourselves, enriching our own lives immeasurably, which is a cool unintended consequence, but I don't even think of it in those terms. It seems like this would be a better place if we all tried to be kind simply for the sake of being kind, but that's me being preachy. What I do know is that for me, in a world often characterized by division, being a blessing is a powerful choice for unity, hope, and compassion. And I'm going to keep on keeping on, as Curtis Mayfield sang back in the day. I can say without that true power lies in the selflessness of the act, expecting nothing in return but the satisfaction of alleviating another person's burden or brightening their day. And we have time for some briefs. Change in time. Tuscola schools will dismiss at 1:30 p.m. December 18th for the Christmas break. VG Blood Drive. Villa Grove will host a community blood drive with Impact Life from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. on Friday, December 19th at First Christian Church inside the Fellowship Hall at 701 North Sycamore Street. To donate, contact Impact Life Urbana at 800-747-5401 or visit www.bloodcenter.org and use the code 70301 to locate the drive. Appointments are requested. Contract negotiated. Dick's Pharmacy is still in network with Illinois Blue Cross Blue Shield. It also includes the Medicaid branch of the Illinois Blue Cross Blue Shield as well. Christmas Bazaar, Saturday, December 6th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. and Sunday, December 7th from 1 to 4 p.m., the Camargo United Methodist Church women are hosting a Christmas bazaar with decorated trees and novelties at the church's parsonage, 104 Mill Street, Camargo. There will also be a bake sale, grave, and cemetery saddles, cones, and assorted nuts. That is all we have time for this week. This is Chris Yerking. Say goodbye and see you again next week.